Welcome to the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed social worker. And we have our experts back on our show. And Xander will do the honors in introducing everyone.
Thank you so much, Dr. On. Well, this is our third panel. We have Dr. Jamison Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Dr. Jamison Green is a pioneering advocate for transgender health, rights, and social safety. He led FTM International from 1991 to 1999 and has served on the boards of many organizations, including the Transgender Law and Policy Institute and the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH. He is the author of the prize-winning memoir, Becoming a Visible Man, now available in print, ebook, and audiobook formats. We also have with us Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper, who is a professor emerita in the School of Graduate Psychology at the Pacific University in Oregon. She currently engages in full-time clinical work in her private practice. Previously, she worked at Seattle Children's Hospital and Boston's Children's Hospital, where she was the founding psychologist for the Gender Management Services, or GEMS, clinic, where she developed the psychological assessment protocol for transgender adolescents who were seeking medical interventions. On March 4th of this year, Environmental Progress, which is a nonprofit research organization based in San Francisco, which was founded by Michael Schellenberger. He's an investigative journalist. They released the WPATH files. The major report of the files was written by another journalist that works for Environmental Progress. Her name is Mia Hughes. The WPATH files contain leaked and public video and written sources that aim to, in the voices of those who made them public, to expose WPATH, World Professional Association for Transgender Health. WPATH has been in existence since 1979. It was formerly known as the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association. They are the establishers of the standards of care for trans people who medically transition. The claim is that the organization has ignored potential long-term patient outcomes and has knowingly skirted informed consent protocols with minors and vulnerable adults, which I believe they mean by that adults with mental health issues. Just to give you an example of what's happening in other parts of the world, in England, the National Health Services has officially removed puberty blockers as routine treatment for gender dysphoria. As of just a couple of days ago, I think they have completely removed them for any minors. Quote, "We have concluded that there is not enough evidence to support the safety of clinical effectiveness of puberty suppressing hormones to make the treatment routinely available at this time," from their statement. So Jamison and Laura and On are all members of WPATH, and I'm a former member of WPATH. So what we're going to discuss is this issue of the WPATH files and what those files contain. We're going to have a more nuanced conversation than what I think you would normally hear from people in your echo chambers. These issues have become quite polarizing. On one side, it's a loud contingent of people who want to shut down all gender-affirming care, right? All gender transition medicine, not just for young people, but also for adults. And on the other end, you have people that want to open it up even wider. And as I've heard Dr. Marcy Bauer say on a couple of occasions, make hormones available in a vending machine. She's not advocating for that. That she's repeating what she's heard other people say. And so I don't believe either one of these is a viable option, nor the correct path to take in trying to sort this all out. So let's see what our guests think about this. Laura, you've heard about the WPATH files, that somebody internal, I think it's more than one person they've said now, has leaked information from WPATH from a private email thread or communication platform that the members use.
It's an interesting situation that we're in with all of this right now. And I think what many people who have seen the files who are members of WPATH or even just professionals who may be healthcare professionals who aren't a part of WPATH probably recognize that at least with some of the conversations that were seen and showed up in the files, maybe most of the conversations actually, it's provider to provider discussions around complex client cases that people are seeking guidance and support for. So it's a forum where people can go and ask important questions so that they can provide the best care. I guess that part, in my opinion, isn't shocking and really shouldn't be shocking to people to know that healthcare providers are having these conversations and trying to sort out the best care for people. The other thing that it probably highlights is the various opinions among providers in the field around how to approach the care. That's a point worth probably diving into a bit more because there really are differing opinions on how to best approach the care for minors in particular. That was certainly reflected in the files.
James, let's jump over to you. How were you made aware of these WPATH files, and what were your thoughts when you first learned about them and read through them?
Well, when I first heard about it, it was because I was approached by Mia Hughes because the WPATH files contain excerpts from a video training panel discussion that I was a part of. So I was going to be appearing in this video, and they were quoting me, obviously. And she gave me some example quotes and asked if I'd like to respond. And I said I would not like to respond, because I think what you're doing is disingenuous. It's taking things out of context and wrapping it in a package that presumes to be conclusive evidence of something that it is not. And it's as if they walked into a play in progress in the third act, the beginning of the third act, and sat down and didn't like what they saw or thought there was something strange about it. So they decided they knew everything that went on in the first two acts, and they're going to critique it. That's what this WPATH files is like. And I think it should be completely disregarded. It's not that we don't have issues in healthcare. It's not that there are not conflicts between patients and providers. This is true in all areas of medicine. And it's also true that trans issues are complex and confusing for people who are not involved. And so I don't denounce or deny any of that. This approach that they've taken is extremely provocative, polarizing, and dangerous for trans people's health around the world.
Jameson, one thing you just said about, I think you used the word disagreement, like between patients and providers. Was that the word disagreement?
There always have been areas of contention between patients and providers. I don't think this is unique to gender medicine. I really don't.
In some ways, now you have providers who are either members of WPATH or involved in transgender healthcare, and they're doing very different things, like in different parts of the world. And so I guess one of the things that most people wouldn't know is the kinds of conversations that go on when you have providers, clinicians, who don't agree on the course of treatment. I think I did hear a medical doctor say that she found it unusual to see the kinds of exchanges on the listserv. And don't doctors have these kinds of discussions all the time? I found that a little bit surprising, but it seems to me that there is this growing difference in how, say, Canada and the United States and England and Finland and Sweden and Norway and Germany and France, maybe there was a bit more universal outlook on these things for a period of time, but it doesn't seem that way right now.
I think also there have been repercussions for people.
Always been true also,
What do you mean on?
which is why standards of care were developed in the first place, to try to alleviate those. Not that they were really great in the beginning, but they've gotten better over the years. Still a growing field of discovery.
I think we do need to remind people of that. Still fairly new, even though we have some history of people having transitioned surgically in other parts of the world, but physicians, surgeons, and practitioners in general, whether that's mental health or medical, have, unfortunately, they've had to answer to their institution. I think that's very real for some of these individuals, and it's threatening to them because their jobs could be on the line, essentially.
One of the things that I think is important to recognize about this particular field at this point in history anyway, is that it is so polarized, as you were saying, Xander, that the forum where internet email files, not the videos, where that was pulled from, I myself do not participate in that listserv or any other professional listserv that focuses on trans health. I have found in the past that it is not a safe place to raise questions or challenge approaches that providers are taking that I may not feel are in the best interest of patients or border on being unethical or irresponsible. So I think that is a very unfortunate reality. And I don't know that there's anything WPATH as an organization can do to control that. I think to blame WPATH for that seems misguided. So I think we should see these as separate issues. I can't necessarily hold WPATH responsible for what providers within WPATH are doing, but I do want to just point out that the culture right now in gender medicine, is particularly with the pediatric world, is so tense. I can't think of all the right words to use for it, but and frightening. It's terrifying, actually, to engage in these conversations. I have chosen to not attend the recent WPATH, USPATH conferences because for the same reason. I'm fearful of how people will respond if I do open my mouth and share what I'm really thinking about some of what's happening. So that's unfortunate. But again, I don't know that that's entirely on WPATH to solve that problem.
Yeah, I was thinking we need to put some frames around subtopics within this because talking about the healthcare system in the United States, you might as well be on another planet. It's very, very different in the United States. The WPATH standards of care literally are not rules, they are guidelines. And this is something that one of the critiques in the WPATH files is that WPATH is laying out these rules and telling people they have to do this and do that. That is not true. If you read the actual standards of care, they are guidelines. And WPATH has no policing power over any clinician anywhere in the world. But what WPATH does is try to be a conduit for information about the population of trans people and the providers who care for them. It's a membership association of providers, not of trans people. And they don't give instructions to trans people. They only provide a forum for providers to share information, learn from each other, and grow the field of this type of medicine, which is very much needed by the trans people in the world, regardless of their age. They still need health care in general, and sometimes they need gender-specific medicine. Just say, well, let's throw out the baby and the bathwater. Basically, you're then depriving all trans people of their responsible health care and of any kind of learning. Let's just start over. Let's pretend we're going to build a whole new world from scratch. That isn't going to happen.
This is some of the language that gets used. This is life-saving, medically necessary, evidence-based medical care that's decades old and the science is settled. And then on the other side, you have people saying, well, it might be consensus-based, but it's not evidence-based because we know what evidence is and there's been no scientific studies done that follow the protocol of what's evidence-based. Or science is never settled. Science is always moving.
That's actually true. That's the answer.
This is a growing field. It's growing, even though transition medicines has been used for, I don't know, what is it, like 70, 80 years, six, seven, 8 decades worth of availability.
More like 100 years.
Well, hormones in the 40s, right?
Surgeries began in the 19 teens.
It's been around, but it's still emergent or growing, yet claims that the science is settled. And it's evidence-based, and that's where the polarization starts. You have people who put hands on hips and say, no, it's not. And you have no proof of that. And then on the other side there, we've got decades worth of proof. Look at all these trans people. And that's not a level of evidence that should be taken.
That's not a double-blind, random controlled trial. That is unethical in the context of living people. That's not how it works.
In European countries, they take data from several decades where they've been tracking patients in centralized databases, and they start sifting through it and calling people and bringing them back and having them fill out forms. As far as I can tell, as a non-expert in this, it doesn't look too good. They're coming up with all kinds of findings that don't support a lot of this stuff of life-saving, medically necessary, evidence-based, and the science is settled. How do we step back from people who are standing on the ledges of it's all good and people who are it's all bad? If you can't talk about it in the email threads and you can't talk about it at the conferences, where is this conversation supposed to happen? How do we get people off these ledges?
Stop attacking people, stop attacking our colleagues, and start trying to have a nuanced, reasonable conversation where you don't fly off the handle. And if you feel compelled to fly off the handle, just stop yourself. Just don't do it. If you want to really be reasonable, you've got to be reasonable.
Well, we are talking about adults who are professionals, licensed, certified.
That doesn't mean you don't have emotions. Being licensed and certified does not mean people don't have reactions. And people do get sucked into polarized positions for odd reasons, for odd individual, personal to them reasons that we will never get to the bottom of on a large scale or be able to make use of. One of the medical system issues in the United States is we know that many trans people can't get any kind of medical care, or were unable to get any kind of medical care absent insurance coverage. So to help defray the cost of any medical care, there was so much prejudice against trans people that they couldn't even go to an emergency room and have your laceration in your leg because you fell off your bicycle bandaged up because that was a transgender leg and you were ineligible for coverage. And this has been true across the United States for decades. And yet people have managed to get care, but always on an individual basis, either by pretending they're not trans or building relationships with providers who would care for them in spite of the insurance exclusions, or working many jobs and saving money for years and years to be able to get some kind of care. This kind of medicine would never be taught in a medical school until it was going to be reimbursed. That doesn't happen in socialized medicine. If it's not taught in medical schools in countries with socialized medicine, there's a different reason. There's a different rationale for that. So this is, again, we're talking about apples and oranges if we're talking about medical systems making decisions. So we were able to start having insurance coverage. We couldn't get health insurance in the United States for transgender people, where people could be openly trans and get bronchitis, for example. Just literally health care for a human being denied through insurance. So by getting insurance coverage and then being able to start trying to do more education and get this education into medical school so that we could create or have a cadre of medical providers who were better trained. The ground for having that is the fact that this medicine has been delivered for decades in this country by a small group of doctors, and representatives of that group have come together and over time continually revised the standards of care. And the standards of care are guidelines. And we're trying to keep it as broadly stated as possible because we can't address the different medical systems. We don't control the medical systems. We don't control the doctors.
This is the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Kagg, and our two panelists, Dr. Jameson Green and Dr. Laura Edwards Leeper. We will be taking a commercial break, and we'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one supplement brand, help you put back what life takes out. All-in-one comprehensive formulas created to offer you maximum benefit, whatever stage of life you're at, and with a range that supports everything from immunity, energy, cardiovascular health, joints, cognitive function, menopause, and even beauty. We've got you and your family covered. Premium ingredients packed into a powerful daily sachet. Simply mix with water to activate for a flavorful health drink. Perfect at home or on the go. Revive Active. Available at selected Holland & Barrett stores, Well Pharmacies, and online at Amazon and reviveactive.com. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world, and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. This is Dr. On with Xander Kegg and our two experts, Dr. Jameson Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Dr. Jameson Green was talking about the role of WPATH offering standards of care to providers who practice transgender mental health care and medicine. Let's pick up where we left off. And I wanted to mention, too, that I think if we could be advocates in the moment that a trans person experiences a setback with their medical care, if we could be present in that moment, at least I would direct that individual to file a complaint with the risk management department. And if they're hesitant to file a complaint, to at least state, I just need to talk with you. I don't really know how to manage this. Could you please just listen to my story and go that route? Because as it stands, people are lost and they're left hanging and there's no recourse for them.
Right. I understand that. And that's one of the driving forces behind making the standards of care as comprehensive and as robust as we possibly can, so that people can turn to them from all kinds of fields that are related to the provision of healthcare, and look at those standards of care and see that, yes, there are people who work in this field. Yes, there are people who benefit from this. Yes, people need to be treated better. And how do we do that? If all you want to do is say, well, we don't like the fact that there are trans people in the world, so we got to stop this right now. Let's go after WPATH. That's the standard of care. And that's nothing. It's not nothing. It's a collection of decades worth of research, a growing, a rapidly expanding field or body rather of research that does support the evidence base. That is the evidence base. And that is true in every field of medicine where you can't have double blind, gold standard clinical trials. And there are many, many health conditions which are not appropriate or that kind of study. It's just like when you say, well, the hormones are used off-label. Well, many, many medications are used off-label. FDA approval for a specific condition is not possible with probably over 50, 70, 80% of the drugs that are available and that are prescribed for a variety of conditions where things are not on the label. So these are red herrings. They are meant to alarm people. They are meant as a dog whistle to call people to action. It's not that everything is perfect. It certainly is not. I've seen people who have been butchered by surgeons. And I think it's less so than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, because now there are more surgeons who are qualified, who are doing work on trans people.
Where I see the problem really lie is related to providers who are not following the standards of care the way they are intended to be followed. And again, that goes back to my earlier point about not blaming WPATH standards of care for the problems that we're seeing. So I really think it's more of an issue among providers within the field who have differing philosophical approaches and ideas about what the best care is and the best process for providing the care. And again, I'm speaking more about young people here, but I think that's, in my opinion, why we are where we are in terms of all of this blowing up and the WPATH files being such a big deal is some due to people who just do not want trans people to exist or do not believe that trans people exist. And of course, there is that sentiment out there, no doubt about it. But I also think that there is a valid concern that people are bringing forward regarding the way youth are being treated in this field by some providers and some clinics. And that is very upsetting to me as someone who helped bring this care to the United States for minors. It's near and dear to my heart, and it's been my career. And through my entire career in this field, I have been very passionate about trying to educate and train other mental health providers to approach the care, the assessment, the mental health piece of the work in the way that the standards of care intend. And when I don't see that happening, it's always concerned me. And what I've seen in the last several years is just more and more a movement away from following the standards of care the way they're intended to be followed within the youth world anyway. And that's the part why we have such an issue right now. Honestly, I think from my perspective, we could talk for hours about all the different reasons that there are these different perspectives and philosophies around the care. And I think a big part of it, honestly, is just the number of youth who are coming forward. And so people who really aren't well-trained are trying to provide the care because they care about youth and they want to do the right thing and they want to help. And so they maybe go to a trans 101 training that teaches affirmation only, meaning quick stop and then medical interventions. And they think that that's the best way to approach it. And they don't know any better. Again, they're maybe have good hearts and they're wanting to do the right thing. But as we're seeing with an increased number of minors, young people coming forward, and the cases getting so much more complex than they ever were when I started this work about almost 20 years ago, from my perspective, the need for more thorough mental health involvement and assessment is something that we just can't deny. It's hurting the field to cut corners.
I agree with you completely, Laura. I think that people need to be very, very careful before going into any kind of medical intervention. And I think that the problems are brought up within the trans community, basically often because of economic barriers to accessing care. And I know in the UK, for example, even in the socialized medicine world, there are economic barriers to accessing care because the wait lists, the number of providers available, they've got 5-year wait lists. And that's not good. In spite of this, what they've said, as Xander mentioned, that they're going to no longer prescribe puberty blockers for young people. The National Health Service is also working to open regional gender centers and with a broader set of expertise to support children and families in making these decisions. I think that's good. Of course, they haven't done that yet. It's delayed. Who knows why? Probably financial. Again, it's about access. And then we get it all confused with all the other elements that go into actually providing care. Do we have clinicians who are really equipped and capable of handling these patients? Do we have the right surgeons around? Do we have the right hormonal preparations? Do we have a deep understanding of what these patients are going through and all the elements that go on in the patients' lives? It's a very complex field. And each patient is different. Their family situations are different. But I think a lot of the pressure, at least in the United States, under our system of medicine, the pressure is probably economic. And that creates this all or nothing. I'm not getting enough. I'm not getting anything. I'm not getting enough. I need more because you're cutting me off because I don't have the money. And other people are getting this for free. And why can't I? And so why are you getting in my way? People just feel it's a constant barrier. The medical field itself can't solve that problem. Standards of care can't solve that problem. And that's part of what creates this polarization.
Laura, you had mentioned early on something about what is the best approach. To a certain extent, dirty laundry has been aired. There is not a consensus among providers and clinicians who are working with trans patients and clients.
Don't overgeneralize.
I don't think they're supposed to be. I think the message that people outside get is there should be a consensus. There is one. Again, the science is settled, which I think came from Admiral Levine. Right? The science is settled. When you hear the science is settled and then you get to read the unedited back and forth message board, I think that the people who are skeptical and the people who are disapproving, and they're alarmed by this now. And so now what happens? The WPATH president, Dr. Marcy Bowers, put out a statement. I don't think that tamped down the flames at all. It might have even been gasoline on a fire for some people. So how do we go about trying to start resolving some of this? Some people are staying involved in WPATH, but starting other things. You know, we got Therapy First, which is about 300 clinicians around the world, mental health clinicians, that are starting their own thing. And they're saying therapy, psychosocial support, and psychotherapeutic services should be the front line, especially for children. You've got the SEGM, Society for Ethical Gender Medicine. So these are people who used to be WPATH members. Some of them, I don't know if all of them, maybe even some are still are. Sometimes that's what happens. There's a disruption in a system, and so people leave the system and start new systems. Some people stay in the system and try and reform it. Some people stay in and work with the others on the outside too. These are all different approaches. Laura, let's start with you. You've stayed a member, but you don't engage. Mm-hmm. Membership isn't free. You're paying into something that you don't really seem to be able to get the full advantage of. But I'm just wondering what you think is a good approach for how to save this somehow or set the boat on the right course that where everybody can actually be engaged, that you don't have to censor yourself and not attend events. What are you thinking?
Well, I definitely have been in the group that has stayed in WPATH, but has also been trying to reach across the aisle, I guess you could say, to understand where some of these other people and members of these newly formed groups, where they're at, what they're trying to accomplish, and also to try to be a voice of WPATH in those groups to set the record straight a little bit about what was intended by the standards of care, at least in the child and adolescent chapters, because those were the two that I was a part of, and to try to help people in those groups understand some of the research that I'm more familiar with a bit better. And also to go in genuinely interested in understanding and hearing their perspective. And I have to say, they have some very valid points and concerns. And they also, I have found, at least some of these groups, they are very open to hearing what I have to say. They are so grateful that I'm there. They're interested in being more communicative with WPATH to try to work together. In some cases, I can speak, I think, for Erica Anderson, who's not here today, unfortunately, as well, because she and I both have decided, not exactly together, but we just happen to both agree that this is not a bad idea. In fact, this may be the only thing that really saves this, is if we can try to start communicating among these different groups. But I think the other piece that I think is important to add is that within WPATH, I wish that we could get to a point where there could be more open and honest conversations around these topics, because those conversations are happening more in those other groups, sadly. And so that's part of the reason that I am on the fence even about the upcoming WPATH conference. Do I want to spend the money to go to a conference where I'm not sure that those conversations are even going to be had? Whereas some of these other conferences, they are having those conversations. And so I wish that members of WPATH who attend these conferences and participate on these listservs could recognize that we're all on the same team. We're all in this because we care about gender distressed young people, transgender identified people, anyone under the umbrella, the transgender umbrella. And in order to move the field forward and work together against some of the things that are happening that none of us agree upon, like the bans, et cetera, we have to be able to communicate safely and openly among ourselves. And we also need to find allies in these other groups and with them and figure out ways that we can coordinate our efforts.
I have been trying to do that, talk across that divide. And I don't think I get the same level of respect that you do because I'm not a clinician. What do I have to say about anything? I have traveled all over the world and done a lot of work with different governments and different health administrations. I'm not exactly your average trans activist. I've been a moderating force historically, and I've been involved with WPATH since 1998. I actually had my first meeting was in 1997, and I joined the association in 1998 membership year. My entire reason for being there was to make them do better, to make them help trans people better. And my understanding, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding here. There's misunderstandings about the terminology informed consent. There's misunderstanding about gender affirmation. My understanding of the concept of gender affirmation was that, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, when a young child and their parents come in and they say, this is my gender, and that the advice is to be affirmative, that you hear them, That's to establish a rapport. That doesn't mean that you say, okay, that means you're on the road. You're going full bore down this path. No, that is not what gender affirmation means.
Or what it was intended to mean, I think is important.
That's what it's become, though.
What it's been twisted to mean, yes. But I think that it meant originally meet the patient or the client where they are. But then you've got to dig deeper and work through the issues to find out really where they are, how they got to where they are, and if they know where they're going. Do they really understand it? That's the job. And I wholeheartedly encourage that to be the job. And I think these conversations have happened within WPATH. WPATH only meets once every 2 years. There's only a little bit of communication because there's over 4,000 members. Everybody's not talking to each other. People who are chosen for the committees to work on the standards of care are chosen pretty much for their reasonableness and their ability to be fair and open and diligent about the evidence and to be able to frame the issues in an appropriate way. That doesn't mean that every member is part of that group that does that work.
I was doing a talk on Saturday for a group of individuals in Washington State, and I was told during that talk that they had just passed a law in Washington State to ban gender exploration therapy because it's conversion therapy. So what a clinician does in helping a young person to explore, any age of a person to explore, is now deemed conversion therapy. That's also been written about in law journals. Gender exploratory therapy is conversion therapy. And so they're trying to get it outlawed now. And I said to the person who made the comment, I said, what we need to be careful of is that we don't have people who are doing conversion therapy practices and calling it gender affirming or exploration therapy. If it's true, just basic psychotherapeutic exploration, that's just basic psychotherapy. Of course, you know, they're going to challenge it, but this is what's happening. Just basic, let's explore this, is now in a certain segment of the trans community, and our quote medical allies are considering that not only conversion, but gatekeeping and anti-trans. So now you're a transphobe if you want to help a young person or any person explore these ideas that they have about gender. And polarization is that drives people who are like, wait, what? Why can't a therapist explore? It drives them crazy. Then they just say, I'm washing my hands of you and I want you all gone. I want WPATH to be gone. I want trans medicine. I want it all gone. They just want to scrap it all.
We are about to take our second commercial break. This is Dr. On with Sandra Kegg and our panelists, Dr. Jamison Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. Stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, Every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You are listening to the Umbrella Hour. We are back from our second commercial break. This is Dr. On with Sandra Kegg and our panelists, Dr. Jameson Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. We have been discussing the polarization centered around transgender care and medicine. Let's pick up where we left off.
Right. My concern is that people who hold those views are gaining steam, and we've seen how successful they've been across the country. We've got to find a way back. And I think the only way back is for WPATH at the top, the board of directors, to say, we are going to have open conversations and we will not allow people to shut down conversation.
I agree with you 100%. In the face of these attacks, WPATH has been advised by their legal team. I don't know who they are. They're contracted legal people. They're not anybody I know. To not respond. Stay in the ivory tower. You'll be fine. I think that that's incorrect, frankly. I think silence is never an answer to a burning issue because it just continues to burn.
The airline industry made some mistakes, and then they learned from those mistakes. They have made some tremendous improvements coming out ahead and discussing the transparency that is needed so the public can know and be affirmed that, yes, what they heard is correct or not. And then they come back and they update the public.
There's a difference between WPATH and a corporation. Yes, WPATH is a corporation in the tax structure in the United States because they're a registered nonprofit, but they're an educational nonprofit. They're not in a business. WPATH doesn't treat clients. The members treat clients and patients. WPATH doesn't provide any service other than a meeting place for professionals and standards of care. That's all. And the International Journal of Transgender Health, quarterly journal. Inside a corporation, the board is engaged in making a profit. Board is engaged in providing that return for the shareholders. The board is interested in the kinds of things that are going to make the company stronger and better. WPATH board is a collection of volunteer clinicians who are not business people. They are not responding to shareholders. They are basically busy providers of care.
But they're still in the ivory tower because you have attorneys directing them to be quiet.
Well, some attorney is directing them to be quiet. Yeah, that's right.
Well, in some ways, they have shareholders in the members.
And I think they're making a mistake. But the members aren't asking them to do anything. The members are just waiting for them to do something.
I wish the members were more engaged. That might be the route.
From 15 years sitting on the board, not been on the board since 2018, the board doesn't know how to manage an organization. That's not their professional skill. So they're doing the best they can, and they're drawn in many different directions. And I think they're just scared. I think they're scared, frankly. They don't want to be involved in a conversation where somebody's going to yell at them. And believe me, I've been yelled at plenty. I've been yelled at from both sides.
This isn't just some uncomfortable currents on the water. We're talking about tsunami. Tsunami level with the media and the organizations. It's not pretty.
I agree. And I have said this. Well, let's wait and see what happens at the next meeting. Maybe we can have a conversation there. That's what they'll say. I'm not going to be able to be there. I'm very sad about it. I can't afford to go. I don't know what they're going to do. It's disappointing because I've spent a great part of my life trying to make things better for trans people. And WPATH is the institution with the greatest expertise and longevity and authority in the world.
And maybe it's just time for a different business structure.
Well, they got a different business structure when I became president and improved things significantly. That's how we got Standards of Care 8. Mm. That's how we got to be providing training. That would never have happened until I became president. A lot of people wanted it, but nobody actually could make it happen. So I changed their management and changed their structure. The management is a contracted association management firm. They manage over 25 different small medical associations. They're stretched thin. Everybody's doing the best they can. And if people weren't being polarizing and taking things out of context and twisting them and trying to be provocative and taking advantage of the idea that people want trans people down and erase trans people from existence, which is never going to happen. I'm sorry to say. No, I'm not sorry. I'm very proud to say it's never going to happen.
Yes. And we need to stop saying things like the science is settled. We got to come together somewhere in the middle here.
Right. And overgeneralizing about anything is dangerous. The people on the listserv is a small, tiny, tiny number of the full membership.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jameson, your explanation of just some of the structure of the organization is super helpful for me, even, you know, as a member and someone who's been involved, but just has never been on the board or has really understood it in that way. And I do agree with you 100% that they are probably doing the best that they can. And given all of these circumstances that no one could have predicted, the way this is all unfolding, it's like a soap opera or something every day. I think where I feel disappointed is, maybe you share this, I don't know, you have to say, but I feel there have been certain forks in the road in these last few years around the youth gender care, where WPATH could have maybe been more outspoken, clarifying what affirming care is supposed to be. You were talking about earlier, I could go on my soapbox about that because I I get so frustrated about how that term has been hijacked to mean like fast track medical treatment. It's not the word exploration. We had to take that out in our adolescent chapter in multiple places because we were afraid of being accused of being conversion therapists, which I have many times been accused of, by the way, because I do use the word explore all the time in describing what I do in my affirming model. That's one example of something I feel that perhaps WPATH, with the help of the experts in the child and adolescent on those committees and involved at the higher level at WPATH, could make a statement about that, clarify what we mean by some of these things, which would really be a stronger voice in the field that maybe would help move forward.
That's what I've been agitating for that. From the get-go, WPATH started putting out policy statements after I'd been on the board for 4 years and finally got them to start putting out policy statements that would clarify things that weren't clear in the standards and what the organization stood for and what the organization meant. That hasn't happened since I've not been on the board.
That's very unfortunate. And I do think that would be so helpful.
I agree with you. And I have said to the people that I know on the board that these things need to happen. We're not professional communicators either. I do have that skill. This is what I strove for when I was there. And words have important meanings and we bandy them about. And we don't have an understanding of what the people who are listening to us, where they're coming from. We make assumptions about that. And that's where big disconnects happen. This is a human thing. I mean, all people do it. It takes a very, very skilled communicator to immediately grab the empathy of the listener, unless you're angry. When you're angry, you immediately grab the empathy of the listener. It doesn't matter what you're angry about, but people either cower or you drop in a few words that are buzzwords in the moment, and oh, they're right there with you. They're just as angry as you are. And then they think it was their idea, as if that's their new position in life. That's the kind of world we live in right now. And it is crazy, if you ask me.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that about them not being good communicators.
That's not their jobs.
Yeah, that may have been why they were told to not respond until people can think things.
Could be. Could be. Could be.
This is our third panel that we've done together. So I'm so thankful that you made the time and you were willing to come back and to talk about this important topic. Thank you so much, Jameson and Laura.
Thank you both.
Thank you for
having
me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me too. appreciate it.
We have come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. This is Dr. On, clinical sexologist with Xander Keg, licensed social worker, and you are listening to our panel of experts, Dr. Jameson Green and Dr. Laura Edwards-Leeper. We hope you join us next time. Thank you for listening.